Thank you for all these things. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen. Well, Mark and I have been doing this series on naturalism. And once again, Mark, would you tell us what naturalism is?
We'll define naturalism simply as the notion that all natural events have natural causes.
So when Carl Sagan says the cosmos is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be, that's an example of naturalism.
That's actually an example of materialism.
Okay.
Yeah. And materialism distinguishes from naturalism in that materialism is the view that all things are made of materials and forces that act on those materials in our physical universe.
Very good.
That there's nothing outside of that.
So there's no supernatural entities.
Correct.
And isn't this the predominant view in science right now?
Naturalism is, because it is a function of methodological naturalism. And and it's unavoidable. The scientist has to operate using methodological naturalism. And what methodological naturalism is simply the operation of the experiments and the interpretations of the experiments, continually looking for natural causes of natural events. So you presume a natural cause for all natural events. If you didn't, you couldn't do science. If you just waited and said, well, there's some supernatural explanation for this, you would be depriving yourself of answers that God could give you from the natural world. So methodological naturalism is the idea that we will use a method which requires us to look for a natural cause for all natural events.
But you're not saying that all natural events are only caused by natural causes, are you?
That's right. And that's an interesting problem because we don't have a clear-cut way of explaining when you would appeal to the supernatural. Although what's happening now with technology and with the advances of science, particularly in cosmology on one end of the spectrum, and quantum physics on the other end, that there are some things at the tiny, tiny quantum level we don't know the nature of, and some explanations for things at the cosmic level that we don't find natural explanations for. For example, the origin of the universe. Those are things where we're bumping into boundaries where we are actually having to talk about supernatural potentials. So is it potentially the case that we will have to rely on a supernatural explanation for natural events? Science is bumping into that now because of the advances in technology, and it's a wonderful thing that God has given us a technology where he's forcing us into that situation.
So if there is a supernatural world and there are supernatural causes for natural events, at some point methodological naturalism is going to run its course, and everyone is going to have to say these explanations that we're trying that are naturalistic are just getting more and more outlandish and more ridiculous. At some point, aren't you going to have like a Kuhnian crisis where they're going to have to be able to say, we're out of ideas. We can't explain this any other way.
Yes. What you will end up with is a question of with which faith will you adopt?
Yes.
And will I have the faith that science will prevail, that science will ultimately find the solution to the origin of the universe or to the origin of matter or the origin of life, for that matter, because they still haven't figured that out scientifically. And if the answer is, well, we'll just wait, then that is a naturalistic faith. That is a faith that a naturalistic explanation will come. But it's a faith that's unfounded.
It's really naturalism of the gaps.
Naturalism of the gaps.
They accuse us of using God of the gaps, of inserting God when we don't have an explanation. But they do exactly the same thing, inserting naturalism when they don't know yet.
Yes. But it's also, to be charitable to the scientist's position, it's also important to realize that they have to do that almost all the time. There's very few situations where they don't do that. There's very few situations where it doesn't call for that. I mean, most of the time, almost all the time, we have to presume that there is a natural explanation. So you get back to this question, how do we determine when we have bumped into a real wall?
Right.
The metaphysical wall between, or the metaphysical wall, the wall that separates physics and the natural realm for what is purported to be outside of that.
Well, I shared with you yesterday, Mark, a quote that I found in listening to videos and reading stuff, and I think we should share it with the class because it kind of opens up this idea. This is a very provocative quote, and I'm going to read it. The most insidious evil of supernatural creationism is that it stifles curiosity and therefore blunts the intellect. This is by a man named Richard Dickerson, who is a molecular biologist here at UCLA. There's a lot of different directions, Mark, that we can go in with this quote. What do you want to, say something about it?
Well, the first thing is, in some respects, he is exaggerating the effect of using God of the Gaps as an argument when methodological naturalism would be better.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, although that's an exaggeration and I would never use that terminology, it's true that if we were to constantly plug in God did it on all of our research, we wouldn't get very far. We would just be happy with where we are. We would just, for everything that we don't figure out, we just say God did it all. And so that would be evil, and that would stifle curiosity, and it would blunt the intellect, because the intellect wouldn't be in operation. As soon as it ran into something that was challenging, it would just stop. Well, he's not too far off. But there's more to it than that, and I think that's where we're going to go.
Yeah, because, you know, if you think about it, virtually every scientist before Darwin, and almost half of scientists today, believe in a personal God, and yet there's a whole lot of brilliant scientists that don't allow this to happen in their science, even though they have faith in a creator God.
Yes. I mean, if you look at some of the most important figures in the history of science, they're either theists or they're overtly Christian.
Right.
And I was listening to I forget who it was, but an atheist who was talking with a Christian about this very question. And the question that was posed to the atheist was, well, you know, if you really don't believe that there's a God, then why do any of this work? And the answer was, well, we'll find things that will give us meaning. And the retort to that was, well, how do you find meaning in physics? There isn't any meaning in physics. Meaning and a purpose is something that's not physical. That's either emotional or ethical or even, that's what the other person was saying, is that the Western notion of science as we have it today, the development of sciences, is really an enterprise and a set of disciplines that correlate and ask questions and then share the knowledge, arose strictly because of Christianity.
That's right. The idea that the universe is comprehensible and rational, that idea would never occur to someone who outside of the Judeo-Christian faith, because they don't have that idea. It comes from the Bible, that there is a rationality and a detectability to the universe, because God is one and God is rational.
And you could be, though, you could be, let's say you're an atheist in the weak sense. And I mean, an atheist in the weak sense is a person who just says, I haven't seen the evidence for a God. So there's at least two kinds of atheists. One kind of atheist is what I would call a strong atheist. And that strong atheist says there is no God. That's one positive position. The weak atheist is one says, well, I just don't believe that there's a God because no one has shown him to me. So if you're, either one of those atheists, but let's say you're a weak atheist and you say, well, I just haven't seen any evidence of God. Can I do my science without having any concern about God? Well, yes, you can. You can do really good science without even being concerned about God at all and having no sense of purpose from God. The atheist is going to say, well, the more we look into science, the more we will find that God does not exist. So you have the weak atheist saying, I can do science without God, and as I'm doing science, I don't find him. And the other one, the strong atheist, saying, the more we do science, the more we'll find God doesn't exist. So it's interesting that those two different paths from those two different forms of atheism actually work very well. They work well in the sense that they push science forward. They do advance science. Now, I'm not an apologist for atheistic science, but we have to be real and honest that you can do atheistic science. And one of the people who talk about that is A.J. Roberts, for example. She has a brilliant example of having talked with students that she was working with or teaching. I forget what the situation was, but she says, you know, we talked about how we could do all of the science without ever having to talk about all this biological science, without ever having to employ, for example, the theory of evolution. So evolutionists say, well, everything has to be interpreted in terms of evolution. No, actually, you can do quite good biology without ever having to invoke evolution. The same is true of any physics or biology, where you can do quite good experiments and ask good questions without ever invoking God. So how is it that science arose from a Christian worldview in the way that science exists today? Now, you mentioned it. I mean, so you talked about how we had scientists who explicitly were looking for the beauty of God or the orderliness of God, the mind of God, on the basis of knowing God.
Right. They saw it as a way of getting to know God.
They did.
Thinking God's thoughts after him.
Yes.
Who was that? Kepler? I don't remember.
One of them
said that.
Listen, one guy really smart one, yeah. So what does that tell us about science, naturalism, and what the project of science should be? And it tells us that you could come from either camp, any one of those three camps. Let's call them three camps. Strong atheism, which says the more research we do, the more we're going to find out God doesn't exist. The other camp, which is the Christian camp, which is, no, you're going to do research because the more you find information, you're going to find that God does exist, and he actually is the Christian God. And then the third camp, which is one, says, well, I don't know either way, but I'm open. You know, if you show me God, I'll go for it. That all three of those ways are interestingly open to anybody who walks into science and to anybody who actually uses methodological naturalism as their means of finding knowledge, one kind of knowledge. And it's important because some people say that science gives us all the knowledge we need, and I think you don't have to work really hard to prove that false. So I guess as we're going along here, we should consider those three different streams. Mm-hmm. The atheist that says we're going to find that God doesn't exist the more science we do. The Christian who says the more science we do, we will find that God does exist. And we'll actually, looking at Romans chapter 1, we will find out more about the nature of God,
right?
His character, his eternal power. And then the other one who says, I'm looking.
Those are three good positions.
Yeah.
You said that scientists can do good science without God. But I want to take one exception to that, and that is that they're limited, I believe, in the fields that they can study. Let's take origin of life, for example. Scientists have really hit a brick wall for 60 years in trying to find naturalistic explanations for the origin of life. I think it's at the point where that field, at least, has hit that wall that you talk about, where they need to be able to start including the idea of a creator because they aren't getting anywhere else.
Oh, it's true, and if you look at the literature that's between the popular literature and the scientific journals, so there's a sort of gray area between the hardcore journals that just describe the data and rigorous interpretations of the data, and then the popular drivel, the stuff that you see on TV, there's a domain of discourse in between them. And in there, you'll see them starting to come up with things like, well, the origin of life must have been aliens. And so the popular drivel has had that for years. But you have people who are actually your scientists who are starting to say that, and actually been saying it now for over 15 or 20 years seriously. And it's becoming more pronounced because of exactly the point you're making, which is that the more experiments are conducted, the fewer opportunities there are for explanation from a naturalistic, but they keep bumping right into things saying, well, this natural explanation doesn't work, that one doesn't work. We're even finding that we have less and less opportunity to get access to the original data, which would be an absolute bar to getting the answer from a naturalistic. But that would be a technological problem or a technical problem, not a scientific problem.
Right.
So when we see this, we should ask ourselves, how much grace do we want to grant them before we say, yeah, you're done.
Yeah.
And now you have to consider either that this, that life on Earth, if we're going to talk about the origin of life, originated somewhere else and got dropped here, which is called panspermia, or that somebody who you don't know yet isn't part of nature and created life.
Right. And putting it off on aliens really just puts the problem further back in time to another place, but it's the same issue. Where did the aliens come from?
You know what's interesting about that is you're absolutely right, first of all. And second, I was reading an article just probably about 2 weeks ago in Science News, and it was an article on, and that's not popular drivel stuff, that's good stuff. These are actually scientists who know what they're talking about. That what Hugh Ross has been saying all along about the habitability problem of planets around solar systems is getting worse. And that is that there are some planets that we thought could harbor life that can't, and then we haven't considered other planets that might. And the point was that some of the discussion now is that our so-called Goldilocks zone, you know, NASA's so-called Goldilocks zone, is a farce. That just because you have the different forms of water on a planet don't mean that you have the possibility of life. And so they've actually come up with, I forget the number of terms, but it might have been something around 9 or 10 different things. They're starting to realize that they have to have that Hugh has been talking about now for almost 30 years. His list expands, and I don't know how many he's up to now, but just this year, solar scientists and exoplanet researchers are starting to move more in the direction of Hugh Ross's idea, which is it is extraordinarily difficult to harbor life, not even talk about starting it. And I see a question in the back.
Yeah, you're talking about the wall. It seems to me it would be in atomic science, because they keep finding smaller and smaller particles of matter and energy, and the rules, the laws that carry out their actions and what they make, everything is based on that. Without that, you don't have life. And there it is. And how in the world could this have it evolved? It had to be God that did it.
Thank you.
Dean's got a question.
Looking forward to Mark Clark coming out? Wow. So I hear that Christianity being important to the development of the sciences over the last couple thousand years. And it's easy to say, okay, Judeo-Christian worldview where there's really, you know, a creator. How about the Muslim input? It seems like over the last 2,000 years, there's so many important Muslim scientists, the invention of distillation, and many others. They had also stockpiled a lot of the ancient books that the Europeans had lost, And today still, in the sciences and schools, you see so many Muslim names. Maybe there's something in common where there's the creator God being important and having this kind of agency to be able to explain things. And we could see how for them as well, and a huge part of the Earth's population, they have been very careful with a creator is just one God, not the you know, the pagan and all these other things that have gone over so many other places in history. And they're also a culture that has been very careful with science. And if we expand and not just say Christian input, but input by the faiths that hold to a creator God, then it's marvelous.
There's all the great Muslim scientists and mathematicians lived in the 11th century and before. There has not been much in the way of Muslim science for about 900 years. My understanding was there was an imam or a teacher during that period in the 11th century who said, this is inappropriate, this does not honor God. I don't remember what his reason was, but that stopped it. There's very specific historical reasons why they, in many ways, led the way in scientific inquiry. You know, algebra is named after is a Muslim word. And that happened, and then it stopped. And there is not a lot of science being done in the Arab world right now. And it's because of that imam who said, no more of this. That's my understanding.
Okay.
I want to know if anybody here has a comment on this quote. Anybody want to say anything? There's a lot of different directions we could go with this. Peter?
I think that's really almost like a racist comment. It's not. There's not a lot of thought in it to even bother to discuss. It's simply a statement of bias, but a kind of a bias with an animus behind it. So there's not a lot of thought there to attack anyway. It's just it may as well be white people are stodgy. It's in that realm of comment.
It seems to me that the term insidious evil should be saved for Nazis or Stalin or the human heart. It's a bit over the top, isn't it? Yes?
Just a statement. I think for someone like that to even use the word evil, what does he even mean by that? How can you have evil or good then? Yeah, if there's no God, exactly.
Right. Is there any evidence in this statement at all that naturalism is true?
No. No.
So I would like to ask him, well, what if there is a supernatural world that affects the natural world? How would you restate this comment? Because he's just assuming it's not true. Anybody else? What's that?
I wonder if he goes by Dick Dickerson. It's a ridiculous statement. It just disqualifies him. He should be careful.
Well, last...
Do you know what the context of that was and why was he even talking about this?
It was in a paper.
Having a bad day or what?
Yeah. Okay, so the story behind this is, do you guys know who Philip Johnson is? Philip Johnson was an attorney. I think he's passed away now. Yeah. He was an attorney who really started the ID, intelligent design movement. And I was listening to a YouTube video that he did in 2012 this week. And that's where I got this quote. And he referenced it from a paper that he had that was called The Game of Science, that was written by this guy, Richard Dickerson, who was a molecular biologist. Philip Johnson believes that the paper was written because of things that Philip Johnson said in a talk that he gave. So the paper was really directed at Philip Johnson in his opinion, because he didn't like it. And so it was a paper about why science has to be naturalistically based, and that he said in the paper that the very first goal of science is to do everything we can to try to find naturalistic explanations for things without invoking the supernatural. Nothing about making sure we're stating the truth or overstating our claims, that the main purpose of science is to make sure there's nothing supernatural in it, basically, is what he said. So this is from a paper called The Game of Science, and it was published in I have it here, if you will. It's published in the Journal of Molecular Evolution, so it would have been around 2011 or 2012. I tried to find it, but I couldn't. Ruth?
That bothers me, because that in itself would stifle curiosity if you only stop at naturalism. I mean, if you do not question it. You know, isn't that the whole purpose of science, is to question all aspects, not just say, this is it and we're done. That, and creationism to me is saying not only who's the source, and once you find it, how did the source do all the creation? That's the part where you enhance curiosity.
Very good. Right. So limiting yourself to a naturalistic outlook can stifle curiosity and blunt the intellect, is what you're saying. Anybody want to say anything about that? That's a really interesting viewpoint. Mark, you want to say anything about that?
I think there's something that's parallel to that, and that is that, what's the sense of doing science if you don't believe there's a supernatural? Okay, if there's no end, when you die, you're just dust, and there's nothing left. If the human race is just going to go extinct, if 2 generations or 3 generations from now, no one will ever remember your name, who cares? Why, scientist, do you even care about a supernatural explanation? That's an interesting question. And it's an interesting question because it circumvents a lot of the nonsense about, well, you know, you're just God of the gaps, insertions, all. Let's get past that. Let's realize you're going to be putting your wishful thinking in certain gaps, like origin of life, origin of the universe, etc. And we are going to be inserting God into those gaps because we have other reasons to do it, not just because we feel like doing it and we're believing in God. We actually have a reason for using or appealing to God as having done those things, originating life, originating the universe, originating humanity, etc. That the naturalist physicalists don't have, because they can only appeal to what they can see. We can appeal to things we haven't seen. But with what we have seen, we can explain and infer the existence of a God that they have a very difficult time dealing with. So if I were speaking with a scientist who said, well, you know, we can do all of these great things without invoking God, I'd say, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. You can do great science without ever talking about God at all. Just go in your laboratory, do all sorts of stuff. God's not there in your laboratory. You're not going to see him. He's not going to pop up and say, here, push this button. So you're right, to a point. But now my question is, Mr. Scientist, Mrs. Scientist, what are you doing? Why are you here? Your science will never answer that question. So you can bubble up all the things you want in your beakers and your test tubes, but you're not going to bubble up the answer to that. So let's get into something that's even deeper than just the scientific question. Because the scientific question is really easy to answer. You're going to bump into things that you can't explain, and that will never be explained unless you have faith in science overcoming it, or faith in God. So why continue? You're going to have faith in something. One thing or the other, you're going to have faith. A faith that science is going to prevail, or a faith that God will be the answer. I see a question popping up here.
Well, what's silent in that statement is meaning.
Is what?
Meaning. He's assigning meaning. He's assigning evil to motive of someone who would posit God. But there's science is for the world of facts. Science doesn't give you meaning. You know, there's a world of meaning, and that's what the humanities are or were for in the universities. And in the Bible, in great literature, there you have meaning. But from science, you have interesting facts, but they don't lead you to what those facts mean. And there's a whole nother realm that you can't necessarily entirely frame with facts, because you have to assemble from the facts what do they mean. And so there's a realm of meaning, and science is really inadequate to go fully into that realm and then go conquer it, which a lot of atheist scientists are proposing, is that this world of facts can go assault the world of meaning and conquer it, but the world of meaning is actually stronger than that world of facts.
In what way is it stronger?
Well, the meaning of something is deeper than what it is.
Okay, thank you.
You know, there's a real snarky way to answer that.
Answer what?
If I'm talking to an atheist who says, as many do, they admit that we have this great need for meaning in our lives, and yet at its core there is no meaning in the universe if there is no God, I would say, well, then you may as well become a Christian and have some meaning in your life until you die. Wouldn't that be better than living your life feeling like it's meaningless?
Well, I've heard some atheists answer that very question. And some of their answers are, well, gosh, if I do that, I forget which one it was, he said, then how am I going to have sex with all these different people?
Yeah.
You know, because Christianity is going to stop me from doing that. And I can't go out and get drunk and party out and do crazy things. And I can't say what I want to say and feel what I want to feel. I'm restricted, so that's why I don't want to play a religious game, because this atheism game's a pretty easy run.
So they have found their meaning there.
They found their meaning temporarily, yes, yeah. Temporarily. And I think that's where we have the high ground, in that they cannot escape. They cannot escape the deep human yearning for meaning. Now they can say, well, that doesn't. We don't care about that. Well, yes, you do, actually, or else you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me about it.
Yeah, there's a very interesting argument that says if God did not exist, we would have no need for him. It seems to me that the fact that that meaning, that search for meaning that drives so much of who we are, has got to have a reason for being there. Evolution wouldn't produce it because it wastes so much energy. You would think it would have weeded that need for meaning out, and we would just be very intelligent dogs and cats just doing what we do, and we could do science, but we wouldn't, the idea of looking for meaning wouldn't even, no one would ever have even thought about it if God didn't exist. It seems to me the very need for meaning is a piece of evidence that there is meaning beyond what we beyond just the stuff we can do every day.
It's an extremely important argument, or part of an argument, and it's one of the reasons why I said earlier that, you know, we have evidence beyond science that shows that science has its limitations and does not answer all the questions, and reasons why we can, those same kinds of evidence, like the question about meaning, the question about ethics, the question about beauty, those kinds of things that science cannot answer, when we look at those and we ask ourselves, what are they, where do they come from, and how can you ground it in materialism or physicalism? And the answer is you can't, even though they've come up with some really acrobatic intellectual way of doing that. They don't work, despite how great some of the philosophers are. Then what we realize is that we have evidence that applies to the question of whether God exists and whether science can answer that question, or how it can answer the question in one of those three ways we talked about: atheism, strong, weak, or Christian. So if I were gonna talk to a physicalist, somebody who says, oh, I believe everything is reducible to physical phenomena, and there isn't any meaning to anything. We're just going to die, and that's it. We just extinguish. I would ask, first of all, are there any rules or ethics in science? Yes, there are. Okay, please give me a scientific explanation for that. There isn't any. So in the very process of conducting science, they're using extra scientific standards to validate what counts as real science or good science. So where do these ethics come from? Are they entirely practical, or are they entirely prudential? In other words, these are the most prudent ways of going, or is there something beyond that? That it's, there's something wrong with falsifying your evidence to be able to come up with a study that will get you money. Well, I have yet to see a scientist who says, yes, it's okay to falsify in order to get money. Now, you're gonna find one, because somebody out there is gonna be that way. But so what you end up with is a group of people who are, on one hand, and I don't wanna say all scientists are like this, because they're certainly not, but let's just talk about the naturalist science, who's at least a weak atheist and maybe even a strong atheist, that if you're going to adopt the position that science explains everything, there's no meaning to anything, and yet you're going to assign meaning to the values that you hold that make the science work, in other words, those very ethics that you have, for example, then you're actually incoherent. Your theory is incoherent. And we have a better explanation. And we'll use our theistic explanation to explain even why you have those beliefs. And that's one of the marvelous things about the Christian faith, is that it does this, and it has all of these other adjuncts that will help us explain these things to people who have never questioned their own ethics, or questioned where they come from, or validated their own beliefs.
Even saying, I just thought of this, even saying a scientist who says, doing science is good or noble, I would say, why? That's an ethical statement. By what ethical standard are you saying that?
Yeah, that's exactly the right question to ask. And I don't know whether it was Michael Ruse, the philosopher of science, who's, I think he still teaches down in Florida, or another one, but one of the philosophers of science that I heard answer a question like that was, well, we just happen to be built that way. That's sort of the David Hume argument. Well, that human nature just does that, and so human nature makes what's good, good.
That's not a very scientific statement.
It's not scientific at all. It's not scientific at all.
When are they ever willing to end with a statement that vague and it's just that way?
Well, that's kind of where you end up.
Yeah.
It is where you end up. But they could look at us and say, well, you just come up with this imaginary God and you end up there. So, you know, who created God? That kind of stuff, which is silly. But you will get that. And the other thing is to ask questions like, if you're going to be doing this, why shouldn't somebody oppose you? Why not? If you think the most insidious evil of supernatural creation is that it stifles curiosity, why not stifle curiosity?
Right.
Why not? What's the meaning in it? Why is there even evil? How can you even attribute evil to anything? Please explain that to me. And explain it to me in scientific terms, not in ethical terms. Well, first, they can't. They're not even the same thing. So that's kind of a silly argument. But it's one that's worth asking. And then the second one is, tell me about your ethics and how they're grounded. Give me a physical explanation for your ethics. Now, I've seen them. I've seen some really good attempts, and they all end up falling down in the same way. Is that they fall back to saying, well, evolution just created us to do what we're doing and to believe what we're believing. Really?
It's pretty convenient.
That's stupid. But that is really where it ends up. It just ends up because we can't go anywhere else. How else do you ground it? And I see why they come to that conclusion, because that they have to regress to evolution creating it, because there isn't any other grounding to it.
Right.
Go ahead.
Val?
Well, if some of you remember, Mark gave a two-part talk on transhumanism. And there are a lot of scientists that really believe in what they're doing in that arena. And they don't want any moral conflicts. They don't want to have ethics get in the way of their creativity and they're surpassing God in the design of people. So I think that's part of the reason they stick to their atheism, that particular group of people that think that they could do a better job than God could do. They put themselves in a position of being more important than any God could be, and that they are going to really advance and make humans evolve in some sicko ways, but this way they have no moral issues. They don't have any ethical issues with doing this or creating embryos where they can take body parts and destroy the baby that created them. I think that's part of, it just kind of goes hand in hand with that kind of thinking, that that way they don't have any limits. They don't have to worry. This is even more insidious than their comment about creationism. As a matter of fact, I would expect someone who would go into that kind of scientific venue as seeing it stifles curiosity and it blunts the intellect, because they want to go in those dark places without any limitations. So if they don't even believe in God, then that would help them on their journey.
And if someone tried to block what they were doing, they would say it was wrong for us to do that.
They're insidiously evil.
Right. So how is it wrong if they're, it's no more wrong than what they're doing?
Yeah.
If there's no God, then it really, nothing.
And what they're doing is far
no right
worse.
It doesn't matter.
With no limitations.
Hope first.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hope, back there.
Thank you. This is just a statement, and it's not at all meant to be off topic or irrelevant, but Mary Shelley addressed this question as a 16-year-old writer in the book Frankenstein, and it's nothing to do with the movies you see. Everything this lady just said is brought up in the book, and the problem with Dr. Frankenstein, and he's a scientist in the book, he wants to go to those places with no restriction. And it's such an interesting book. It's very short, and I would tell anybody in this class to read it. You're going to see those topics addressed, and it's not at all to do with Hollywood movies. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. And you know, that's important, because science has ethical implications. And again, you know, just as the advances of science and are pushing the boundaries of metaphysics and pushing the boundaries of science to metaphysics. So it's taking physics and saying, okay, we're running to the edge here. Now we have to ask for explanations, and those are metaphysical. Just in the same way that technology is pushing those boundaries, technology is also pushing boundaries of ethics. Your description of the human 2.0, the transhumanism, and then your discussion, Hope, about Frankenstein, you know, the author already getting into that. Yes, during the age of reason, recognizing that the powers that are created by the technologies, whether they're in the 18th century or the 21st century, are so great that the question that follows is, how do we use them? At that point, science can say, we don't know, that's not our problem. We're just going to keep on making things. But science lives in a community. And that's where science has to be restrained and understood. And then the question is, okay, scientists, who among you will be the arbiter of what gets done next? Who among you will say whether you're going to create babies that are blueprinted, and who among you is going to determine who gets them? Are you only rich people get them? Do only some people get certain things? There's all sorts of, are you going to use this to create a monster race to overcome another nation in a war? Are you going to create soldiers so that they're invincible? These kinds of things, what if that gets given to the enemy? There are practical and ethical problems. So science creates its own ethical quagmire, which is an interesting thing. And we need to be able to hand that back to the scientist and say, you're not in a vacuum. Now we have a question here, Ruth.
Randy and I recently went to a funeral. His boss's sister passed away. She was my age. And when we were at the funeral hall, it was a few hundred people. The first thing they pretty much said is that she is a scientific person. She comes from a scientific family. That was like pushed, the first thing, science. And I just said, okay, where's this going? The chaplain in the whole time did not mention not one word of God. Her children, not one word of God. Her own family, brothers, father, not one word of God. And it was so depressing to sit there the whole time, first time in my life to be at a funeral, that it wasn't mentioned not once. And how she, this lady, how she was helping the community and doing all these things for the community, specific details, and how she really believed in science. And the, and then the chaplain said, and she will help the soil, her body that's passed into the soil, it will enrich the soil, and the worms will eat her body, and it will say yum. And I'm thinking, is this what I'm hearing? I was shocked. I'm like, these are all really highly educated people, and this is what I'm hearing. And I thought, mom and dad are sitting right there, and you're saying that? And again, this is shocking to me. And this is all in the name of science.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not, I can't imagine what it would be like to have somebody say that my loved one who just died just became a fast food restaurant for worms. You know, that would not be, make me feel good. Yeah. Please.
Yeah, I was at a funeral home this weekend as well, and it's awesome as a Christian that we can be present in a spiritual way sometimes. What I looked up Richard Dickerson, and interesting, 1992, at the beginning of this, it's a short little paper where this is quoted. He has, science fundamentally is a game. It's a game with one overriding and defining rule. Rule number one, let us see how far and to what extent we can explain the behavior of the physical and material universe in terms of purely physical and material causes without invoking the supernatural. So if they can remember, okay, but right now we're just doing material causes and without invoking God, but then leave the university and say, go to someone's funeral or to a wedding or to a birth, and then say, okay, now my rules of academia, that's not on right now. Or if you're talking to someone on a train, maybe someone that doesn't care about science at the time. And so we could be thankful that we can be easily reminded, oh yeah, this is not all about, you know, just strict logic right this second. Hey, there's more to life than that. So maybe talking to someone like Richard Dickerson, okay, I'll go with you while you're writing a paper and trying to find more of the material causes in life. But hey, that's only 8 hours a day, you know, if you can really pull that off.
Thank you.
Is Richard Dickerson someone that Dr. Ross has debated?
I have no idea.
Okay, anyway, I was thinking, the reason why Western civilization was so developed above any other civilization is because of the influence of the Bible. And I know that Dr. Ross has said a number of times that the scientific method came from the Bible. And so, I mean, that idea that, you know, believing in God, the supernatural creationism, stifles curiosity is just wrong, because it's the Bible that has influenced people to be to learn about things and to be curious and to figure out how God did it. So I disagree with that guy.
That's very, very good. Thank you. It's the Bible that honors the individual enough so that an individual can say that I'm curious and intellectual and say that that's a good thing. Before the Bible existed, those wouldn't even be qualities that an average citizen would be honored for. Dan?
Yes, it looks to me like it comes to this. It boils down to, how do you know what you believe is true? When I talk to Mormon missionaries, they answer me, oh, because I have faith. I said, well, faith is trust. I happen to fly, and there's a little airport here in El Monte. Would you like me to take you up and show you the city from above? They will not say, well, yeah. Well, you don't, because you don't trust me. You don't have faith. And faith comes by hearing from the Word of God. The more you know about God, the more you trust Him, the more faith you have. And so I tell them, everything I believe is based on the Bible. Everything. And I use an acronym called MAPS. Manuscripts, archaeology, possibility, and statistics. All those signs come to a conclusion that the Bible is not a man-made object or book of books. They are scientific, supernaturally. The Bible is a supernatural book by God. It's you cannot go away from that and come to that conclusion.
Thank you, Dan. Well, last time, Mark, we did this, we left a cliffhanger for the class. Remember, we were talking about reasons that naturalists give for why naturalism is true, and we were taking those one at a time and beating them up.
Mm-hmm. That was fun. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, if we've beat this up, do you want to go to the next one of those, or do you want to keep talking about this?
Well, it depends on the group, but
yeah.
I think we've... Well, we haven't really exhausted that, because there's a lot of other ways we can go, a lot of directions we can make out of this. And before we go any further, I want to mention that, you know, as we're doing this format, this sort of informal way of going about talking and then going in all sorts of directions, we want you to know that there's a purpose to this, that the reason we're doing it is that there are natural tangents to these thoughts that we have, all of us, and we want to follow some of them up for one purpose, and that is that when we have the chance to meet with somebody, some part of this may come up in your conversation, and hopefully you will remember it, or at least think about it and have thought about it, so that if you don't feel like, well, we're just talking one subject and going straight through, and we should do that, I'd like you to consider that there are good reasons to go off on all sorts of tangents sometimes. They are productive, and what I have found from people talking to me after the class or emailing me later on is that we never know what we say or what gets said in the class that has some profound effect on somebody. So keep that in mind and remember the things that are most important to you and be prepared to use them, because that's why we're here.
Yeah, I proposed going somewhere else, and now I want to say something about this. I think we need to keep in mind one thing. The idea of naturalism, the idea behind it is really that everything that happens has a cause, and the causes are predictable. A natural cause. That's a really appealing idea. Even for a Christian, that's an appealing idea. Think about it. It means that maybe not me, but some future generation could entirely understand some natural phenomenon. We have to keep in mind that many people are naturalists, not because, at least in their own mind, they're anti-God, but simply because it's a really wonderful idea. It's a very appealing idea. It means that eventually we can fully understand the universe and imagine what we could do for, you know, medicine and helping people and science and all of that stuff. So I just wanted to say that, because it's easy to beat up on everybody who believes this stuff, but many of them believe it because it's a very appealing idea. And if we can work towards that, we can all work together and be brothers and kumbaya and all that stuff, which doesn't say anything about the human heart, but it is an appealing idea.
And it's practical.
Yeah.
It works for a while.
Most of the time.
Yes,
yeah.
For a while, and most of the time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for us, as those of us in this room, we all ought to consider ourselves apologists, that we do have to give an answer for the faith that's within us, and with gentleness and respect, to appreciate what position they're in. They're in a position that's practical, it works, but it's temporary. And they're not asking the questions about meaning and ethics that are intrinsic to the very activities that they're performing.
Yeah.
And we need to call attention to that. And we can do it just by asking the questions, like the question I asked. Do you believe that there's ethics in science? Yes, where do ethics come from? Where in science do they come from? Didn't come from science. Ah, thank you. Let's talk about that for a while. Who is or what is the arbiter of ethics? What's the arbiter of the good? There's all sorts of questions that come up that once you pry into this and start asking the right questions, people will stop. I've heard even really high, very, I want to use the word high end, but very sophisticated philosophers stop because they get to a point where they realize that they just can't mumbo jumbo their way any further. And that's where we want to get most people, just say, all right, let's at least understand that there is a rational and reasonable argument to be made for the existence of God and for you to follow Jesus Christ, that it's not entirely non-rational. There have been people in the past like David Hume and Immanuel Kant, very famous philosophers, who said, we're trying to prevent people from having evidence-based belief in God. Hume created a gap saying that, we're stuck in our perceptions, and the only reason we have any kind of belief in God or the supernatural is because it's just built into our nature. So go ahead and do it, but just realize you don't really have any reason to have this belief. And if you want to have faith in God, then that's all it is. It's just a faith. There's no real proof for it. And then he had his argument against miracles on the basis of saying, well, this never happened before. I mean, that's not the regularity of the world. And then Immanuel Kant said, well, the world as it is inaccessible to us because we form it in our minds. And it's a lot more complicated than that, but basically what he said is, if you're going to believe in God, you're going to do it as a leap of faith, not because you have an evidence. So there isn't an evidence for God. You have to have a leap of faith. So there's a stream of that. And what we want to do is we want to defeat those by saying, actually, we do have access to the real world, and you believe it because you live it. And actually, you can have evidence for your faith, even though you can't have a concrete certainty the way you would with a math problem. So let's talk about that.
Thank you. I want to say one thing, too. When you get into a conversation about this subject, remember this one place that you can go. The place where naturalism breaks down the most severely and the most obviously is in the question of origins. Just remember that word, origins. The natural flow of biology. You can study biology, like Mark said, your whole life and never bump into where is God in that cell. But where did the first living system come from? Stick to origins. Origin of the universe. Origin of consciousness. Origin of life. Origin of morality. Origin of humanity. And the reason that is such a powerful argument is twofold. Number one, it's the one place where everybody can say, "Yeah, I can see your point." But the other reason is that it almost identically maps the places that the Bible says God intervened. What does it say about where the universe came from? God did it. What does it say about where the first life came from? God did it. What does it say about where human beings came from and consciousness and morality and ethics? The rest of the Bible, often the Bible speaks of the rest of reality just carrying on like it seems to. But it's a really good way of addressing it, because you can say, this is where it breaks down, and there's this book over here that was written a long time ago that seems to say the very same thing.
Well done.
Thank you. We've got 10 minutes. What do you want to do?
You want to bump into one of these? Well, first of all, are there any comments or questions from the group? Good. We have a few.
Let's hear from Mel.
Then we can come forward. Ruth has one.
Mel's always got something intelligent to say.
Mark, you said that they eventually, many of the scientists you talk to say, well, we've just evolved to this point. So what's your next step then? Where is your conversation going to go?
Please prove it. Yeah, so if you're going to just throw the word evolution at me and say we evolved here, explain how that works. Explain not the whole theory of evolution. I would just say, please explain to me how matter is going to generate thought, how matter is going to generate meaning, how matter is going to do all of these things that we're talking about. And they will always go back to, well, it's just an emergent property, which is an interesting thing we should talk about someday, because that's actually misused. But they'll tell us an emergent property, or the faculties of the brain aren't completely known yet. We know the brain has evolved, so this was the rest of the organism. So we'll get to that later on. But evolution doesn't solve the problem when you just use it as a hand-waving explanation. So if I'm going to ask the question, where did morality come from? Explain to me from two different domains. One would be the physical property domain, and then the next one would be, just explain to me how or why any kind of consciousness should emerge that would create meaning. Please explain that to me. Go ahead. I guess we're going to have a little discourse here.
I think, don't they assume that evolution is survival? So if you had a being that didn't have a conscience or didn't have certain attributes, they wouldn't survive. So it's a survival mechanism. So you would have to kind of have an answer to that.
Well, here's my answer to that. First of all, the appeal to survival of the fittest or natural selection is bogus. I see that as a fallacy. And it's a fallacy because it acts or pretends to be an explanation for a creative activity that it isn't. And natural selection is merely the label that states that things that are too weak to survive die. Okay, well, no argument against that. Weak things die. So please tell me how that creates the very thing that you're saying it creates. It creates nothing. Natural selection is powerless to create anything, even on its own definition, even using completely adopting the evolutionist perspective. So if natural selection doesn't do it, then you have to appeal to something else. So natural selection, I just look at that as a fallacy. It's a pretentious use of a term that makes it seem like they're reasoning and they're not. So it's a label for a mystery, but it isn't really a mystery. The next thing is, if you're going to say, all right, well, natural selection merely makes sure that the ones that don't have these things that you're talking about, like consciousness, etc., then you're still stuck with the original question, which you did not answer with natural selection or survival of the fittest, which is, give me the positive explanation for how they got here. And we're still waiting. We're still waiting. And so when you just throw the term evolution out, it's no better than saying it's a materialist explanation. Was that responsive to your question?
Well, they're just saying there's meaningless variations in say, life. So they're not saying there's any creation of anything. There's just variations, mutations, and so there's no meaning in it, but the weak ones die, but the ones that, so I guess you have to come up with something. Well, enjoyment of music, okay, where does that come from? Can you show me how that a being that has music will survive, and the one that doesn't like music won't survive? Is that a productive way to go?
Well, you can go that way, but the whole notion of evolutionary psychology is a joke. The idea that we can analyze how our psychology evolved from people who we don't talk to, can't connect with, or have no understanding of, is ridiculous. We can't even figure ourselves out, and we have psychological people studying people who are alive today all over the place. So that doesn't help us, that doesn't help them any to say variations occur and mutations occur, and that's why we have all of these different psychological features. Variations don't produce anything. Variations are products of something. So the question is, how do you get the products of intelligence, of mind? And then once you get to the point of having mind, then all of these interesting things like abstract notions. Where do these abstract notions come from? Do we just create them, or are they already there? Are beings that are sentient and have minds with the capacity to have thoughts like the beautiful, the right, the good, how can you say that that comes strictly from evolution when there's no evidence that evolution could create it other than the claim that it's there? Just please give me the evidence. I'm willing to hear it. But don't wave your hands at me and tell me meaning and love and joy and all of these other things are the result of natural selection purging the opposite of those. Because guess what? We have hate. We have the evil, we have all of these things too. So why didn't it purge those? Which is kind of a silly statement, because I disagree that natural selection would even get involved in this. So I guess the long answer is, a naturalist appealing to evolution is just a hand-waving exercise of refusing to actually answer the question. They're just saying, well, it's physical properties occur from evolution. Okay, we just kicked it back another couple of feet, but it's still there. Is that responsive?
When you start saying silly, or you know, that's an adjective without an explanation. So it seems to be very obvious to you, but I think we're so steeped in this all the way through school, and every time you pick up a book to read, they're always talking about the limbic system or the primitive brain, or we've evolved this. It just permeates our thinking. So you say, okay, they don't give an explanation. It just occurs this way, and it's survival. So they would, whatever you posit, like what attributes, they would just say it's a survival mechanism. And so it's not a good argument to say that's silly.
No, it isn't a good argument to say that's silly, except rhetorically. So I would still say it's silly. And the reason I say it's silly is because they're going to say, what do you mean by that? Thank you, I'm glad you asked. What I mean by that is that it's silly to keep using terms that are mysteries as labels without explanation. So merely because you claim that, well, it's this particular physical thing or that particular physical thing, without telling me how, that's silly. That is silly. You're just repeating yourself and uttering different kinds of mysteries and claiming that they explain when they're absolutely not an explanation. That is truly silly. And so I'm not trying to be insulting or simplistic about it, but philosophers use that terminology all the time. And they'll say something is nonsense, or something is just silly, or something doesn't make sense. It's not an insult. It's a demand that somebody provide the evidence that they haven't done.
I think I got a way to beat that up, Mel, that is really easy to understand and anybody can do. Assume for a minute that they're right, that the average person understands that evolution, they say that evolution is about survival of the fittest. Let's say that that was really true, and that all the forces of evolution were working towards creating a being that its sole purpose was to survive and reproduce. What would that being look like? How many of you have seen the movie Alien? Right? Remember the monster in Alien? That's what we would be if all we were doing was being bred to survive and reproduce. Things like love and passion and meaning and beauty, all of that stuff would have been whittled away because it would have been wasteful in the search for the perfect being that survives and reproduces. So there is no evolutionary advantage to all those other things. The evolutionary advantage would be to a being that sole purpose would be to survive and reproduce and was completely sociopathic about it. It just did that. That's not what we are. If evolution is true, after all these millions of years of evolution, we've got all of this baggage that evolution can't explain. We got one question, then we got to wrap.
Yeah, just a comment, just off what you're saying. How did evolution create Mozart? Why did he even exist?
Right.
I mean, there's no need for it. None. We should be that alien. Just an ant. Just
That's right.
Make more eggs, make more ants, and move on.
That's right.
There's no point to it. That's all.
That's right.
Thank you.
Mark, would you close us in prayer?
I would. Thank you. Lord, in all these things and all the wonders that you've presented to us and that you will present to us in the future, keep our hearts and minds open to love those who have not yet found you. For none of this is meaningful unless it's to glorify you. Lord, it's not our ego or our answers or our arguments that matter. It's you who matter, and the people that we're speaking with who need you, and the people who love you and the people who haven't learned to love you yet, Lord. This world that you created is a world that was intended to be bathed in your love and spread that love through us. Please, Lord, help us to do that. Give us that power. In the name of Jesus Christ, we ask you for that. Amen.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.